ECFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
The final whistle has gone. A half-head supporter on the pitch with the AFC
Bristol Athletic are an established local football club attracting players from across the city.
We have Saturday and Sunday adult teams and a new under 18 side. We support players from every community.
I'm 19, I am 27.
Why not join or support your local community club?
Log on to bristolathletic.co.uk for further information.
This announcement has been sponsored by istyles.co.uk. Accessorize your iPhone, pad or pod.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. New evidence how the Twin Towers and the Building 7 were brought down not by planes, but by controlled demolition. Plus, next weekend looks set to see one of the biggest peaceful protests yet at the Hinkley Power Station. With Lib Dem Energy Minister Chris Hume now out of the way, the stage is set for the Battle of Hinkley. And a look at who really runs the world examines the dangers of the combined power of the media and the police when, as the phone hacking scandal, it turns criminal. But first, an alternative film festival started this week in Bristol and has been taking place also over the weekend. We talked to one of the filmmakers and hopefully we'll get a sneak preview of some of the material that's going to be on over the weekend. So I'm joined by filmmaker and producer of video news magazine Real News, Sean Day. Hi Sean, welcome to Drive Time.
Hi Tony, thanks for having me.
First of all, where and when is the festival on?
Well, it's on right now. It started on Tuesday, so there's been a film screening every night on a different topic. One night was like migrant workers and immigrants. The second night was women's politics, and we were showing a Real News film last night on the riots in Tottenham, because we're actually from the area in Tottenham, and we were basically completely disgusted at the corporate media's response to the riots and felt that the people of Tottenham needed a chance to speak out about the fact that someone had been murdered.
Happen from time to time, doesn't it, that when something happens in your area and you happen to have a video camera at home, that's the thing to do in some cases, I think, is to actually go out and do your own record of events in the knowledge that, for example, with the poll tax riots in the 1980s, that the mainstream media simply isn't going to be telling the truth on the news that night.
Well, that's right, and there's a part of our film is an interview with Professor Paul Gilroy from the LSE, who was basically talking about this marketing idea that's used a lot in advertising, that there is a golden hour. So when an event happens, you have a golden hour immediately afterwards where whatever you say, that is the truth that gets fixed in the public mind. You can go and deny it 24 hours later, and in fact the Police Complaints Commission did actually come out and say no, Mark Duggan wasn't armed, no, he didn't have a gun, and yes, the police killed him with a machine gun. But by that time the idea had been fixed in the public's mind of what had really happened. So we were trying to redress the balance. Now obviously we're only an independent group, but when we put the film up on the net, it's had more hits than any other film we've ever made, basically. So I think a lot of people were waiting for a film where, you know, the people themselves who were so angry with the police that day actually had a chance to speak out.
So, I mean, there's been obviously a lot of controversy spiralling right around the world about the summer riots. What, in your view, what was the actual cause? And was there any justice to the way that the public, many members of the public, hoodies, these kind of people, came out and rioted?
Well, I think I'm just going to talk about Tottenham because that's, you know, the area that I live in and around. There's no question in my mind, and I think if you look back at the history of riots, not just in this country, but all over the world, riots are started by the police. pure and simple. Every time there is a riot, it's because of the police either murdering someone, causing extreme acts of some sort, which is just completely out of order and pushes a community that has often had a lot of harassment by police to the point where they can't take anymore. And that's definitely what happened in Tottenham. Not only murdering somebody who was very popular in Tottenham, had four children, who had never been in trouble with the police at all. And remember, Tottenham is an area where this has happened before on a number of occasions. People have been killed and no justice has been served. Even then, people peacefully walked up to the station and were left out there in the cold for 5 hours. And finally, when the police did come out, the first thing they did was beat up a 15-year-old girl who was shouting them, "Where have you been?" And at that point, people just had enough. And what we had in Tottenham was a battle against the police. There's no question about that.
But hang on, I mean, you said that it's always caused by the police. Some people do go to demonstrations, don't they, wanting a fight. You know, this is essentially we're equipped to have battle with the police for, you know, admittedly a tiny minority. This is how people, some people get off politically. They see the police as the main enemy and they'll go in and they'll fight them.
Well, I mean, certainly in Tottenham that wasn't the case. When people finally started fighting back against the police, and it was about 4 hours later actually, the things that they were picking up were things out of the local supermarket. So they found some shopping trolleys and then they found some bricks and stones, but this is only after the police have been charging them with horses and batons and all the rest of it. And I'd support people 100% in their, you know, in fighting back against people who are in self-defence. I also think there's a level of having to defend your community there. Now at that point, you know, if you're talking about people going in who are tooled up, I don't think there was any evidence of that. What happened after Tottenham, I think you have to ask the people in those communities why what actually happened. I'm pretty convinced that if we didn't have the full story in Tottenham, we probably haven't got it anywhere else either.
Okay, well, tell us about Real News. Why did you decide to start that?
Well, we started, I mean, a number of us in Real News.
This is R-E-E-L,
R-E-E-L, yes, Real News. Part of that is a bit of a homage to Newsreel, who did some great footage of the Black Panthers in the 60s in America and various other civil rights protests. But we started, some of us came out of indie media, all of us have come from trade union backgrounds, and we were very inspired by the start of the anti-capitalist movement and seeing, you know, in the Seattle protests against the World Bank and the WTO, seeing kids picking up this new technology and using it for themselves to report on their own struggles rather than having to rely on the mainstream media to do it.
This was back in 1999,
yeah. And there was also, I think, another precursor of that was June the 18th demonstrations in London, where you had people transmitting live from the demonstrations onto the internet, and we thought this was quite amazing really. So that was the inspiration to get going on this stuff. Once we got started, it became clear that nobody was really, although, you know, a lot of direct action, the anti-capitalist protest was being covered, nobody is really systematically covering workers' struggles, strikes, demonstrations, etc. So Real News was set up really to fill that gap, as well as, you know, we cover everything else, but we do put a particular accent on workers' struggles.
What about financially? Because it must be quite, I mean, in a way, you're trying to be a little tiny production company, and the object is to be right over the country, if not even into Europe and places like that. It must be very difficult to actually pay for this.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, we run on a shoestring. None of us get paid at the moment. And we, you know, we try and keep expenses to a bare minimum. All our funding basically comes from, we bring a DVD out every 2 months, which has an hour and three quarters of films on it. We keep the price low so people can afford it. So that's £5. So you can take out a standing order for less than the price of a pint a month, £3 a month. Then we send it straight to your door, and that helps us get a steady income flow. And then we also get the rank and file trade union branches subscribing for £50 a year. A lot of them give us a lot more than that if they're actually lucky enough to be in control of their own union funding. So all our funding comes from ordinary people and rank and file trade union organisations, which means it's been quite hard over the last first few years to build it up. But now we're getting to the point where, you know, it's getting easier all the time, but we still need more subscriptions and more sales all the time. And that also allows us to put the stuff out on the net for nothing, so everyone can see it. It also means that we can stay independent. So when somebody's breaking the anti-trade union laws, like the electricians recently, we can openly support them. We don't have to worry.
Tell us about that story. That's not one I've heard of.
It's the electricians. No, I think a lot of people haven't heard about this because there's been pretty much a news blackout. Whether that's deliberate or not, I'll leave other people to decide. But as far as we can see, we've been covering and helping to put out information about an industrial process that's been going on for 7 months, which has just had a major victory, and we think this is the biggest victory for 25 years. Where it started from was eight building companies, major ones, who had about 90% of the work in the country. So your likes of Balfour Beatty, they were the ringleaders of this, Lang O'Rourke, Crown House, Tommy Clark, NG Bailey's. Some of the biggest firms in the country decided unilaterally to leave a national agreement, which has meant that there's been no strikes for 40 years, and rip it up, bring in new terms and conditions, probably the headline one of which was a pay cut of 35%. And these are from firms that aren't struggling. They all had work for the next 3 years. They're all making pretty big profits, particularly Balfour Beatty. They're also all firms that have blacklisted, illegally blacklisted building workers for trade union activities. And I'm talking about things like complaining about asbestos on building sites, complaining about unsafe practices that have led to deaths of building workers, and they've been told they can't work.
So you're saying that if an individual electrician raises a safety issue, for example, with their boss, that they could be blacklisted and then not get work in future?
Mm. And in fact, there's the electricians found a file that was leaked to them of 3,214 names of building workers, all of whom have been blacklisted and have never worked again. There is actually going to be a front page spread on this in The Observer, finally, this Sunday, exposing this. It is completely illegal. There's been an amazing campaign. What is amazing about the electricians' dispute is that a lot of those blacklisted workers have led this dispute from outside the building site. So 7 months ago, they decided, well, let's start having demonstrations outside the building site. One, that will get on the nerves of the building companies. Two, we can get to start talking to the building workers inside, none of whom were pretty much organised, really. But there were very, at the start of this dispute, certainly in London, there wasn't a single elected union rep anywhere in London. They went from there to, about 2 months ago, they had an unofficial strike in London where not a single electrician crossed the picket line, where power stations were shut down. We had in London a 500 strong mass picket, with people physically stopping people going in, battles with the police, direct action where they were blocking the main road on the side. None of this got in the news at all.
Amazing. What is your relationship like with the mainstream? You know, people like Channel 4 News, Newsnight, people like that. I mean, do you ever phone them up and say, we've got some great footage, would you like it for tonight?
No. No, they don't. There's two things to this. I think I've done it in the past, rung up, and they've sort of said, well, we're not very interested in that. Broadly, most of the time. The other thing is, when they've rung us up for footage, I remember the first time they rang me up for footage was after the Genoa protests in 2001 against the World Bank and the IMF. And they said, have you got any footage of Genoa? And of course, we've been there the whole time. And he said, yeah, we've got great pictures of the big trade union demonstrations. We've got some really inspiring stuff of actions. And they said, have you got any violence? And at that point, we thought, well, we don't want to sell you anything, really, because we're not going to have any civil control over that footage. So, you know, it's going to be used in a way that we wouldn't want it to be used. So in the end, we've decided to operate independently of the TV stations. It's great when you can get stuff on, but we found that it just takes too much of your time trying to get them to do something they're not interested in anyway.
But I mean, it's, you know, they'll pay for it, surely. They'll pay for footage like that if you can, and also you can decide which footage you send them.
Well, this is true, but I think that the reality of it is most of the time they're not interested. I mean, to take the electricians' view, I know other people have tried to sort of get people interested in it, and they're just not interested. They said, oh, people aren't going to be interested in a dispute like that, even though this is, you know, the biggest industrial dispute for 25 years.
Okay, well, it sounds like a fascinating little magazine, DVD magazine, actually. Mm. How do people subscribe if they're interested?
If you go to the website, which is realnews.co.uk, you'll be able to watch a lot of the films on there, and you'll also see a donation subscriptions tab on the thing. Very easy to find. Just go on there and you'll be able to subscribe on that, download a standing order or pay by PayPal. You can also buy all the DVDs there. If you haven't got any money, then just watch them on YouTube or watch them on our website.
Okay.
Or go to one of the many free screenings we have around the country.
Fantastic. What about this Radical Film Festival, which is finishing on Sunday? Whereabouts is that taking place, and have you got any further presentations to do there over the weekend?
It's at the Cube Cinema, which is, oh god, I'm not from Bristol. Thank you.
No.
It's not Portland Square, is it? It's
King Square. Yes. Yeah.
Right. So it's the
off Jamaica Street.
That's the one. It's at the Cube Cinema tonight. There are a couple of environmental films on, and then we're doing a session tomorrow afternoon on video activism in the UK, along with camcorder grillish movies. And
now, look, loads of us have got these camcorders. How do you actually get from being an ordinary person playing with a camcorder and filming your holiday to someone who's actually out there filming the news?
I think one thing is you have to learn how to edit. Two, you've got to be prepared to not have a bit of money for a bit while you can take all the time it takes to edit these things down. But if people have got footage of campaigns that they're in, or they've shot something and don't know what to do with it, get in touch with us. You can send us the footage, we'll edit it for you, or we'll help you, we'll show you how to edit it or whatever. So get in touch if you've got footage like that, we'll help you do something with it.
Okay, Sean Day from Real News, thank you very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thanks, Tony.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, a group calling itself No New Nuclear is staging what it calls a No More Fukushima's demonstration next weekend. Not this weekend, that's the 10th and 11th of March. And to discuss some of the latest developments in the proposed new nuclear station near Bridgewater, I'm joined by Crispin Aubrey from the Stop Hinkley campaign. Hi, Crispin, and welcome to Drive Time.
Can you not hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Okay.
Right, okay, I'll speak up then.
Okay, Crispin, could you just tell us what's going on at the moment with the Hinkley project? So I know that Stop Hinkley is not quite the same as this No More Fukushima.
No, I mean, they're more involved in direction, Stop New Nuclear, but basically there's been an occupation at the Hinkley site for 17 days. Some people occupied a barn in the middle of the field where they want to build these new nuclear reactors. They've just been evicted from there, but it's drawn a lot of attention to what's going on there, and that's all in the build-up to this big event on Saturday the 10th of March, when we're planning to surround the site and show the strength of feeling against the plans to build the biggest nuclear power station in the UK.
Now, what's the significance of the fact that we have lost the Lib Dem Energy Secretary? Do you think there's going to be a change of policy now that Chris Huhne is no longer Energy Secretary?
Well, sadly no, because his replacement, who's a guy called Ed Davey, he also said 2 years ago, exactly the same as Chris Huhne, that nuclear was the worst thing for UK energy policy. The worst thing to do would be to build a power station at Hinkley Point. But he's changed his mind. Now he's in the coalition, now he's energy secretary, he says, let's plough on. So, unfortunately, not a change there. But the point about the 10th of March is that it is the anniversary of the accident at Fukushima. And Fukushima's been a massive wake-up call. I mean, it's shaken EDF, who want to build this reactor at Hinkley. It's shown them that even relatively modern reactors can go wrong. They can result in 100,000 people having to leave their homes, children going to school having to be checked for radiation every day. Lots of people are still suffering from that accident, and that's the reason we're having the event on 10th of March, to mark that. But I also have to say that people might think that the power station at Hinkley Point is a done deal, and you'll see adverts in the papers showing that the people are going to get jobs there. The fact is, they don't have approval to build the reactor, they don't have approval for the reactor design, and the people who want to build it, EDF, don't yet have the finance. So there's still a lot to protest about.
Now, I'm just going to bring old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers in here, because there are a lot of people, Martin, who are saying that actually these new nuclear power stations are going to be not just not economic, they are going to cost an absolute fortune, and also that nobody is prepared to pay the decommissioning costs once the reactor has its life over.
Yeah, well, in the 1990s, I used to work for the New Economics Foundation, and I wrote a paper to be circulated in Eastern Europe on the economics of nuclear power, and therefore I had to research it. And it's quite clear that nuclear power is only viable as a subsidised state planned thing. The private sector in Britain, the Conservative government wanted to privatise the nuclear industry because they were keen to privatise everything. And as soon as the city economists looked at the real costs, unless they were indemnified for things like accidents, they said, we're not going to touch this with a barge pole. So, in actual fact, nuclear power is always a political choice. It's never actually economically viable once you've costed in the getting rid of the waste, which of course the private sector says, yes, if you get rid of the waste, then we'll take it over. But the government's got to take care of the waste. We're not going to take care of it. And of course, the private sector is not always right about things, but about this they are right. There is no economic way to carry out nuclear power Once you've costed in getting rid of the waste, which lasts, you know, thousands of years, and no sensible person thinks that they can manage that, so they walk away from it. And then ultimately, that is the way it should be. That basically, nuclear power is not economic. The only reason why we and the Russians and others developed it is because it was a byproduct of producing nuclear weapons. And if you're producing nuclear weapons, you've got lots of facilities to produce nuclear stuff, so what shall we do with it? Oh, we'll make some nuclear power.
Now, Crispin from Stop Hinkley, Crispin Albury, I mean, surely this idea of, you know, that the no more Fukushimas is totally bogus. I mean, there's no giant fault line, as far as we know anyway, running down the Bristol Channel.
I see. You mean it couldn't happen here? Well, Fukushima is just an example of what can go wrong. In fact, it's not as far-fetched as you might think. Okay, earthquakes of the type that happened there can't happen in the UK, but a tsunami could. In the 17th century, there was a tidal wave that hit the coast exactly where Hinkley Point is and resulted in lots of people dying. The whole area was flooded, and if Hinkley Point had been operating, it would have been devastated. So it's not an impossibility, but the point is that eventually, Hinkley C, if they build this reactor, will become as old as the one at Fukushima. And when these power stations get old, they start to go wrong. For example, the one at Hinkley Point at the moment can only operate at 70% of its power because it's got serious problems inside its core. So it's aging reactors which are the problem, and eventually the bright, spanking new Hinkley C will suffer those sort of problems. And as your co-guest has said, where are we going to put the waste? They have not yet dug this hole in the ground they're talking about. They're talking about doing it in Cumbria. It's taking a very long time. We say, don't build any more power stations until you've actually created a repository or resting place for the radioactive waste.
But of course, the industry will say, well, the reactors that exist are getting a bit dangerous. You know, they're running at the end of their natural life. So we're going to have some new ones.
Well, replace them with wind farms, with some...
There's no way a wind generator is going to generate as much power as a nuclear power station.
Yeah, well, there's a wind farm being built off the coast of southeast coast called the London Array. I calculate you'd need about five of those, something like that, to do the same as Hinkley C. That's a lot of wind turbines, but they're building wind turbines in sort of hundreds in the sea now. So, yeah, it's possible. It's quite possible. We don't have to go down the nuclear route, and if you think... this just isn't feasible, then look at Germany. Germany has more nuclear power operating at the moment than the UK. It's planning to phase that out. It's going for renewables. It's already got 20% of its electricity from renewables. It's planning for 50% by 2030. You know, there are plenty of examples of how established economies, and remember Germany is the most successful economy in Europe, can do this. You can do without nuclear, and it's just a nonsense to pretend that it's essential.
Okay, so I want you to tell us the bottom line. Is this power station going to be built or not? Because it looks like there's a tremendous amount of pressure. We've now got an energy secretary who has quite clearly changed his mind and is now right behind it. And it's also a lot easier for the power companies to get their planning permission now.
As I said earlier, Tony, they haven't got permission to build it yet. They haven't got approval for the type of reactor. It's a totally new type of reactor, this European pressurised reactor they want to build at Hinkley. And EDF has not yet committed itself to finance, £5 billion roughly per reactor. So a lot of money involved. And until that happens, it is not a done deal. Remember, in the 1980s, the Thatcher government planned to build about a series of 10 nuclear reactors. Only one of those at Sizewell has been built. So I think your listeners should realise that these sort of things are always promised, but they don't always happen. So I hope everyone will come along on the 10th of March. Join us at Hinkley Point. Hear some music from Seize the Day and show your strength of feeling. If you want more information, go to the Stop Hinkley website and you'll find everything about the surround event. So good stuff.
Okay, Crispin Albury from Stop Hinkley, thanks very much. And there is another website too with regards to this protest on Saturday week. It begins, that's just over a week's time, stopnewnuclear.org.uk.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now, Martin Summers stays with us as we look at some of the world events, specifically what the convergence of the warmongers and the loan sharks, I like to call it. That is to say, the potential for war in the Middle East, which seems to be ramping up, at the same time as the euro crisis. Martin, do you think it's fair to say this is not looking like a wonderful year for the Olympics with these things on the horizon?
Well, I think the Olympics are a distraction, frankly, from the main things that are going on. As I said earlier, one of the things that I find most bizarre is that we've had the European finance ministers in one room trying to cobble together a deal to save Greece, to save the euro. In another room, the foreign ministers have been agreeing with the Americans and the Israelis that we're not going to buy Iranian oil anymore, which of course pushes the oil price up and makes the deals that the finance ministers are making irrevelant. And that is not joined up government.
Well, I mean,
one hand does not know what the other hand is doing.
We've seen this week withdrawal of the embassy staff, both from Britain and from France, from Syria. I mean, this is creeping closer and closer to a confrontation. Now, it seems that there has been a decision made in the EU and in these Western governments that Assad is absolutely impossible to deal with, although it looks like that the West has been actually encouraging the Free Syrian Army and these armed rebels to not to actually negotiate with Assad.
Indeed, and they've also been infiltrating people from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group into Syria. If you actually peruse the international media, you get a very different picture of what's going on in Syria than one we get.
Well, let's also mention the fact that, because, I mean, it's literally since October last year, on the news almost every night, on the television certainly, and on the radio too, quite a lot in the newspapers, it's been Syria, Syria, Syria. The eye of Sauron, if you want, is moved away from Libya and is now looking at Syria. Meanwhile, we've got nearly 10,000 political prisoners in Libya. We've got no rule of law, where groups of people can go around the streets with guns, knock on people's doors, take over their homes, and we've got torture going on systematically in the jails in Libya, as well as Médecins Sans Frontières pulling out and Amnesty International banging the table saying, look, what on earth's going on in Libya?
Well, the thing that's most interesting is I mentioned the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. One of their leading players is Abdul Hakim Belhaj, and people can look him up on the internet. Abdul Hakim,
if they can spell his name, yes.
Belhaj, Belhaj. He was actually military commander of Tripoli after the takeover in Tripoli, and he is the chief head honcho in Al-Qaeda Libya. And regular listeners to this program will know that the Western intelligence services have been working with Al-Qaeda for 25 years. So he's been on the payroll of the Western intelligence services all that time, fighting Gaddafi, fighting in Afghanistan, and basically now being infiltrated into Syria. I think this is very, very revealing. What's happening is we're finally getting the full picture of Islamic terrorism, and it's actually an orchestra. I mean, inside Syria itself, there was the bombings in Aleppo, claimed by Al-Qaeda, that killed 40-odd people at the intelligence headquarters. And the Syrians just said, well, that's Al-Qaeda, that's you. And, of course, Assad has just had this referendum on Sunday, which they claim 57% of the population voted out of, and out of that, 85% voted for the government's reform programme.
Now, so are you saying
that there are people opposed to Assad? There clearly are. Homs has got a history. Assad's father repressed Homs in 1982, killed 30,000 people, 30,000 to 50,000 people. So there are areas in Syria where Assad has zero support.
So
there are other areas in Syria where he has very strong support. So it's a civil war scenario.
You seem to be saying that the West, NATO and the West, are working with the 9/11 terrorists now in Syria. That's surely impossible.
Well, no, it's not impossible. It's been going on for years. I mean, basically, it's not a secret, is it, that Al-Qaeda was set up by the Western intelligence services as part of Operation Cyclone in the 1980s to teach the Soviet Union a lesson in Afghanistan. And one of the main countries they recruited from was Libya. And these Libyan Al-Qaeda type terrorists have been working with Western intelligence services for years and years. It's not just a recent thing.
Okay, we've also got the presidential election coming up in Russia. What can you have any predictions over that?
Well, I think it's quite interesting. You've got lots of protests in Russia against Putin, very much concentrated in what you might call the Facebook generation. But the opinion polls are quite clear that Putin is likely to win in the first round, and if he doesn't win in the first round, there will be a runoff between him and Zyuganov from the Communist Party. And the Western protégés, like Nemtsov and so on, are nowhere. nowhere in the opinion polls. They're making a lot of noise. There's a lot of money being pushed into the protest movement in Russia by Western intelligence services, National Endowment for Democracy, and so on. And the young, well-heeled are unhappy, as they are in other parts of the world. But when it comes to the ballot box, it's pensioners that decide elections, and they are going to vote for Putin.
Well, we thought we'd find out this week what Bristolians think about Vladimir Putin and whether they think that he's a good guy, whether he's going to win the election or not. So Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to ask you what you think about the Russian elections.
Is Putin a dictator? And does he need to change his style to appeal to the younger generation?
Well, I think he needs to modify his style. I don't think he's a typical or definition of a dictator. He's probably better than anything else I can see for Russia. At this time, I don't see any opposition which is coordinated to take his place. Well, I think his weakest point is probably his own ego. He wants people to like him and to see him as a person. Personality, as a sportsman, as a person who knows everything. He doesn't seem to have an ability to let other opinions in very well.
His styles are out of date. I think he needs to explain how things are being set out for the young people to get jobs, education. To us in the Western world, it all seems hushed up. We don't really know much about Russian people at all.
Russia was being taken over by almost mobsters, and I think they needed him at one time, but I think perhaps it's now time to ditch him. This moment's gone, really. I think it's nice to see Russia become a bit more Western now.
I quite like him myself. Well, it seems like a cool guy.
Putin promises to upgrade Russia's nuclear missiles to counteract the United States missiles defense system. Are they heading for a new Cold War?
It could be, if he really tries to do that, yes. If he wants to bring the Russian potential strike ability into line with the Americans, then he's obviously trying to set up something which would be a condition of sort of equality and just facing off against each other in an angry way.
I thought they were all being dismantled years and years ago. If Russia dismantled so many, the United States did the same. There's no threat of war, but so why does he need it?
Well, I'm less worried about what Russia does, because we're used to Russia, and as long as they've got responsible people in charge, I don't think there's any more the same as the Americans have got responsible. The world would be better without them, but what worries me is states like Iran getting them in Pakistan and India, and the little ones in Korea.
No, I don't think it's anything sort of new Cold War, because it's the sort of thing where they just have it because they have it, like, and no one's gonna start chucking missiles about because they both know they're gonna everyone will be annihilated. And
I suppose it seems like a step backwards, really, but to be fair, the countries still have to keep up to date.
Putin wants NATO and the West against military intervention in Syria and Iraq. Is he right?
He doesn't want that. That's good. I'm on his side, I must say. I don't want military intervention in Syria or Iran. There is a possibility that Western business and Western capitalist ideas try to enforce things in both those countries which are not really to the benefit of the people of those countries.
I think he's getting the wrong end of the stick here, because all that NATO want to do is protect people.
I don't think we should put our soldiers in. It's a difficult thing, because you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And I think with China and Russia, they've got their internal problems, and the only reason they're against people interfering because they don't want anybody to come and interfere in their problem. On the other hand, they could have a point, because civil wars are the worst kind of wars to get into. Better, I think it's a thing for the Arabs to sort out, not us.
Yeah, I think he is right, because the West seem to pick and choose what sort of places they go to. They go to Libya, but they won't go to like Rwanda or places like that, or Zimbabwe. It's been like people have been starving and getting killed for years, but they seems to be like, unless there's anything there that they want, like oil-rich countries, they won't go there. So,
a Western point of view, it's sort of we're a bit sick of it now. We just want to sort of stay out of it and leave them to themselves. I suppose it's just got to that point where it's been so long we've been over there in that sort of area that we're just sort of sick of it.
Now, that was you and your views on Russia and Putin particularly, but Marina Morris is also joining me now for a special report on the Russian election.
Hello. After 12 years, and three terms in power, Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin appears to be the strongest candidate in the Sunday's Russian presidential election. Most Russian polls predict that he will win in the first round. Speaking to the widely trusted Russian newspaper Izvestia, he claims to have evidence of plans of election fraud to be perpetrated by the opposition. He claims not to be against opposition, but to be in favor of the high standards of democracy and fair elections. There is considerable evidence of election fraud in past elections, which Putin intends to discourage by using more than 90,000 webcams streaming live feeds of the Russian public voting. Russians will be invited to view for themselves how fair the elections are in real time online. If one person was to scrutinize one webcam feed a day every day, it would take them about 250 years to examine them all. The population of Russia is about 143 million people, more than double than the UK, but spread over a vast territory, more than 70 times bigger than the UK and 9 time zones. Tens of thousands of Russians have signed up to monitoring these web feeds in all efforts to see fair election. Opposition claims of past massive election fraud by Putin's United Russian Party are also noteworthy. Putin's elections manifesto is clearly aimed at a Russian audience. He claims that the West was behind the Arab Spring uprising and that Russian companies are being pushed out by the new governments in favor of companies from countries who backed up the uprising. He also attacked current President Dmitry Medvedev for not improving Russia's poisoned business climate in a partly concealed comment on the power of oligarchs. He also threatened to expand and improve Russia's stock of nuclear missiles, seeking parity in the numbers that would get through a missile's defense system. In Russia's neighbors, Ukraine, pensioners look up on their Russian counterparts with envy, as Russian pensions are now much better than there. Many Ukrainians envy an organized Russia, the strong government. Putin's selling point to the Russian people is strength and delivering on his promises. But the new generation in opposition claim that this is also his greatest weakness and vulnerability. A free Russia must have the autonomy to develop. Former President Gorbachev recently called Mr. Putin Russia's Margaret Thatcher and said he has to go. Putin has to go beyond his own limits and adopt to less dictatorial and more compassionate and trusting style of leadership to restore the missing link and appeal to the new generation and middle class. Can he do this?
Well, let's ask Martin. Martin, can Putin shrug off this image of this sort of dictatorship? Because you've had Medvedev and Putin swapping these two presidential and prime ministerial roles now for, well, nearly a decade. I mean, it almost seems like a kind of dictatorship by proxy.
Well, it's a bit, I suppose, like the Mexican Institutional Revolutionary Party in Mexico. They used to win every election because they had the levers of power. You know, they had patronage. You know, they could fix things. If you voted for the Institutional Revolutionary Party, they would fix the road for your village or whatever. And it's not a totally open system. But then Russia has never had a totally open system, and people obviously appreciated Putin getting control of the economic crisis when he first came to power, and basically also disciplining some aspects of oligarchic behaviour.
But have we ever had a really totally open system in Britain?
No. I mean, this is what Russians say, is, look, your system is not perfect and ours isn't either, and that's the real world.
But isn't Putin just simply seen as a mouthpiece for the military intelligence community? He was a former KGB.
They call them the Siloviki, don't they? The Siloviki, who are the ex-intelligence apparatus people.
I mean, we wouldn't necessarily want
a Krisha or a roof for the oligarchy. That's how he originally came
about. We wouldn't necessarily like John Scarlett and his dodgy dossier running things here in Britain, would we?
No, but I mean, you know, Russia's got a pretty convoluted modern history. I think in terms of what's actually going to happen in the election on Sunday, I think the opinion polls show Putin probably taking it in the first round. But what the West has also got to realise, if it does go to a second round, I think it would be good for Russia if it did go to a second round, just for the sake of showing that there is real opposition in the country and it does genuinely operate. But of course, the real opposition to Putin is Zyuganov and the Communist Party. It's not the Western protege people. They will not make it to the second round. That's clear. Even though they're making, there's a lot of young people who are demonstrating at the moment against Putin, but they do not have the electoral force in when it comes down.
Now, what about allegations of voting fraud in the previous election?
Well,
and also,
it looks
pretty
much as if voting fraud is absolutely the norm in the United States of America.
I mean, but no, we're talking about Russia now.
Yes, but that's the point, isn't it? Voting fraud goes on all over the place, and Bush probably cheated both times he was elected. It looks like they used electronic voting machines to hack the Ohio vote in 2004, as John F. Kennedy Jr. And John Conyers have alleged. Now, in other words, it's easy to cheat, and there's always cheating at the margin, but I don't see Russian elections as any more or less free than those in the United States of America.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now on to our final world review story now. Stratfor, WikiLeaks and the Obama administration's war against truth. This is an article in The Guardian, either yesterday or today, I'm not quite sure, by Amy Goodman. Martin, Stratfor, this is another, it's rather like the previous Bradley Manning, alleged Bradley Manning leak of all these diplomatic cables a couple of years ago to WikiLeaks, and they're doing a similar thing. They've got arrangements with various news outlets around the world, including The Guardian in Britain, and they are publishing Stratfor's internal communications. Who are Stratfor?
You asking me? I thought there was going to be a clip. Well, I actually subscribe to some of their stuff because basically they're very well connected on the inside of the Western intelligence community. So if you want to know what the CIA thinks or people connected to them, the Stratfor is the website you need.
But
to
the idea is that they're independent, actually, that they're not actually part of the intelligence
community,
that they give an independent view.
They are ostensibly independent, but they have lots of inside knowledge of Western intelligence service operations. So they're seen as, you know, the in-house organisation for the Western intelligence community.
Well, WikiLeaks released this material, at least part of it, the first part of it, at a press conference this week with Julian Assange. But also one of the other people that spoke at the press conference was Carlos Enrique Bayo from their partner, WikiLeaks Partners in Spain, which is a news outlet called Publico. And let's see what he had to say about Stratfor.
We have been struck by the fact that most of the money that came into Stratfor was from public sources, because most of the customers are government offices, agencies, ministries, the military, etc. So it's public money. What Stratfor receives from many subscriptions for its services and analysis. Public money from many countries, and especially European nations, nations that funds and gives huge profits to a private company that acts as a shadow CIA and basically protects US and US companies' interests around the world.
Now, the implication here is that this is a massive intelligence organisation, a private firm, gathering information from all around the world, which is actually really a kind of soft link for the official British and NATO zone, and possibly Israeli too, intelligence services.
Well, that's basically what I said before the clip. I mean, I've been subscribing to Stratfor's stuff for about 6 months now, and they send, they're giving me free stuff at the moment. Like once a week, they send a little bulletin, which I mean, I don't actually agree with a lot of what they say. I think their analysis is often sorely lacking.
Are they trying to create a sort of artificial intelligence consensus, saying this is what they where actually what they're doing is they're trying to steer the opinion opinion formers and politicians' opinions rather than actually give an objective view.
I think there's an element of them basically spreading useful disinformation from the point of view of the people that they basically exist to serve. I mean, I read between the lines of their stuff. I never take it at face value. I presume I'm being lied to, but it's still interesting to get the official take of the Western intelligence services on various, you know, crises that are developing.
Ironically, as part of these leaks, one of them explains that the US government is pulling together an indictment against Julian Assange.
Well, I mean, yes, they've got the information about that, but I mean, pretty much we all knew that anyway. It's hardly a revelation, is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, they've got it in black and white. I mean, people may assume these things, but anyway, what do you think is the value of this kind of thing? I mean, personally, my opinion is on this is that Assange deserves a medal for what he's doing, which is actually getting out what is supposed to be is covered under this whole idea of national security. But when you actually look at these cables, they're nothing to do with national security. A lot of them are simply to do with gagging the press.
Yes, and I think I am worried about Anonymous because who are they? If you see what I mean,
Anonymous. I should add really that's handed this material on to WikiLeaks.
Indeed, but in actual fact, if you look at the internal communications from Stratfor that are coming out, it's exposing them as a front for the Western intelligence services, which I pretty much guessed anyway. I mean, the way they frame things is, how are we going to deal with the threat of terrorism in the 20th century, in the 21st century? And the presumption is that there are the terrorists out there and we're battling with them or whatever. And of course, there's never nary a mention of things like the fact that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, as I mentioned earlier, have been working with the Western intelligence services for 30 years. That's a non-thought.
I think potentially the great thing about this story is simply the acknowledgement in the public sphere that Stratfor exists. Many people didn't even know they exist. They're part of a much, much bigger world. I'm talking about ordinary members of the public. Don't necessarily know that Stratfor exists and lots of their taxpayers' money is going to these private businesses like this, but they are part of a wider web of the strategic communications world, which again is a kind of hidden world. We had recently an on-screen apology from the BBC, BBC World News, explaining how many of their programmes, I believe it's 7 different programmes, had actually been covertly funded by these sort of shadowy strategic communications firms, and so there was actually no editorial independence in these programmes, which the BBC had then shown as if they were an independent programme. It's quite a nasty little world where we're being presented stuff as this is a balanced view, but actually it's all being paid for and it's a one-sided view.
Yes, and it's all being paid for by us. So we provide the taxes to the intelligence services, who then use the money to propagandise us with our own money. And, but of course, if we can expose the financial backers of Stratfor, government and private, then of course that's what every A-level media studies student is taught to do. Who is telling you this? What is their agenda? And people go on about media studies being a non-subject. Well, one of the things you learn is, who's telling us this? What are their funding? What's their funding? Why are they telling us this? Don't just presume you believe everything you see
and
hear.
And also, don't just presume that this is the only programme that the BBC have shown that has been paid for by a strategic communications firm.
Indeed. I mean, and as you know, we've had some contact with ex-British Army psychological warfare people recently, and they were saying, well, basically, we tell the BBC what to say, and they say it.
Bristol Community FM, 93.2.
Susan Lindauer's story is an extraordinary one. Originally a peace activist, she was recruited into the US intelligence service, the notorious CIA, because she was trusted by Middle Eastern leaders. But she blew the whistle after 9/11, saying her own pursuit of potential hijackers before the attacks had been blocked at the highest level. And as a result, she was locked up in a US military prison without a trial for 3 years. She's now written a book, Extreme Prejudice, about her story, and I spoke to her earlier this week about what she believes is the real reason for the collapse of the World Trade Center on 9/11, and more importantly, how it was done.
It was the CIA and Defense Intelligence asset covering Iraq and Libya at the United Nations in New York from 1995 until 2003. My specialty was anti-terrorism, and I was designated covertly by the United States government as a back channel to receive intelligence from Baghdad and Tripoli on terrorism issues. For example, my team started the talks for the Lockerbie trial with Libya, and Saddam Hussein was one of our best sources on terrorism intelligence throughout the 1990s. He was convinced that all jihadis would eventually become terrorists, and he was very worried that they would take advantage of the sanctions and the perceptions of weakened central authority over Iraq in order to set a base in his country. So he was constantly trying to get them out. So he was very cooperative with us.
Now tell us how you wound up in that sort of job.
I was a long-time anti-sanctions activist and an anti-war activist, and I also, uncanny as it sounds, I gave advance warning about the 1993 World Trade Center attack. West, and the CIA wanted to know if I would apply my activism to real-world politics and try to do something substantial that would help get the sanctions lifted. And I was motivated by a deep opposition to the suffering of the people of Iraq. In April of 2001, I was summoned to my CIA handler's office. He told me that he had a message to deliver to Baghdad and Tripoli, and he wanted me to take it right away to New York. When I got to his office, he told me specifically that he wanted to tell the Iraqi government that we were looking for any intelligence regarding airplane hijackings and or airplane bombings. And if Iraq possessed that information and failed to give it to the United States, then the United States would declare war on Iraq and would bomb them harder than they'd ever been bombed before. First, I did not realize the seriousness of it, the gravity of the threat. So I gave them the message in New York, went back to Washington. Richard said, "What did they say to my threat?" I said, "No, I didn't actually threaten them." And he said, "What do you mean you didn't threaten them? I told you to tell those blankety, blankety, blankety's that they better do what we say or we're going to bomb them back to the Stone Age. I want you to go back to New York and deliver the message exactly as I have communicated and tell them the threat originates above the director of the CIA and above the Secretary of State, that it only involves President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. But I was taught always to communicate a message exactly as it was told to me, and that is exactly what I told the Iraqi people. So I'm not telling you something that somebody else did. I'm telling you what I did. In August of 2001, at the request of my CIA handler, I telephoned the office of Attorney General John Ashcroft. Because of the high-level work that we did, I had a phone number that went straight into his office. This is not a phone number that goes off in the ether. This goes straight to his private staff. And we requested an emergency broadcast alert through all federal agencies, requesting any intelligence, actionable intelligence, involving airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center, identified precisely, okay? And I said the attack was imminent, we expected it any day, and this should be considered an emergency priority. We wanted any suspicious information, we wanted any fragment, anything that looked unusual, we wanted to hear about. In Minneapolis, the FBI responded to the emergency broadcast alert by sending information to the Federal Aviation Administration and, you see, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Secret Service and the FBI headquarters and the Attorney General's office, responding to the emergency broadcast alert that they had arrested Moussaoui in Minneapolis when he came into the country, and they had stopped him, and they were asking for an emergency warrant to open his computer. Attorney General John Ashcroft refused to give them that warrant to open his computer. It's an extraordinary thing, because we had initiated the emergency broadcast alert, and then Attorney General Ashcroft stumped us. Intelligence is a bunch of factions. It is not a monolithic organization where we're all lockstep. Every crime requires motive and opportunity, and I believe, even though I know the hijackings did occur, I believe the hijackings were a cover for the controlled demolition of the building. What people have been missing so far was the motive and opportunity. In fact, there was several months' advance notice that the attack was going to occur. There was plenty of time to get to identify the type of explosives that would be necessary, to figure out where they needed to go within the building, and to get the building rigged up. And at that point, it did not matter whether the airplanes were hijacked on September 8th or 9th or August or October. Once the building is wired, it's all ready to go. And this was like a magician's trick. where all eyes were on what the left hand was doing, the airplanes coming over the water, striking the building, and everyone could see that. But the real action that brought down the buildings was definitely the controlled demolition. There are two things that are important to know that have been suppressed. One, at the end of August, between August 23rd and September 3rd, there was strange nightly activity at the World Trade Center. At about 3 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the morning, parking garage cameras captured the arrival of three or four minivan trucks and vans. They only stayed for a couple of hours. The people who reviewed the tapes were able to determine these were not janitorial trucks. They had different colors and markings from the janitorial trucks, and they investigated them. This was an anomaly. They had never appeared at the World Trade Center before. They only came from August 23rd until September 3rd. They never appeared before or after. And we believe that they may have probably gotten other parts of the building wired up. But whatever they needed at the very end to complete the demolition was brought into the buildings in those 2 hour blocks on those 10 evenings. The trucks appeared after the janitorial trucks had left the building, and they left the building before AAA personalities on Wall Street arrived to start checking the Asian markets, which usually happens about 5:30 in the morning. So these people were definitely hiding their presence in the building. They did not want anybody to know they were there.
That was Susan Lindauer there, former intelligence agent for the US in the Middle East, in Libya and Iraq, particularly, and her book is called Extreme Prejudice: The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq. And she was speaking to me from the US earlier this week. Well, that's a serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is Music Night, 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Deputy Leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council and Councillor of Embury, Mark Weston. Also to Sean Day from Real News, R-E-E-L News, and to Crispin Aubrey from Stop Hinkley. Also, of course, to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, the economics of the environment. Is it fair to say the more growth we get, the more the environment is being destroyed? And are there limits to growth? Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk, or even easier, for this show, this week, .org.uk takes us straight to this show and our archives. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.